Friends, we are back for our 14th and final installment of Shuttlepod at the Disco for this season. My name is Jared Whitley. I'm delighted to be with you talking about the season finale of Star Trek Discovery. But I'm even more excited to be here with my three great friends. With me are, she's the Jadzia Dax, the brilliant scientist with an old soul of TrekMovie.com, Kayla Iacovino.
Hey, everyone.
And our graceful voice of wisdom, who always knows the answer to things, the Mr. Spock of Trek Movie, we have Brian Drew.
Hello, everybody.
And the expert who can pull a technical rabbit out of any kind of hat, he's the Scotty of our crew, Mr. Matt Wright.
Hey, everybody. What does that make you, Jared?
I'm like half Quark, half what Tom Paris thinks he is.
I like that a lot.
That's good.
You know what? That's kind of fitting. Yeah. Like I'm good with that.
I've been sitting on that one for a little while. Anyway, okay, so episode 15. Will You Take My Hand? Teleplay by Gretchen J. Berg and Aaron Harberts. Story by Akiva Goldsman, Gretchen G. Berg and Aaron Harberts. And directed by Akiva Goldsman. And Brian, I believe you were going to give a summary of this episode to us.
Indeed I am. And here's a summary courtesy of our friends over at Memory Alpha. With Georgiou at the helm of the plan to end the Klingon War once and for all, the USS Discovery crew struggles to fathom and tolerate her hostile tactics. Meanwhile, memories of past hardships are rekindled within Burnham.
Okay. All right. So this is the last episode of the season. What did we think about it? Kayla, what was your general reaction to the episode?
Oh, man, I have a lot of emotions. I'm going to say that. I don't know if I can actually sum up how I feel about this episode in our like brief snippet like we usually do. There were things that I liked about it. There were things I really didn't like about it. I would say that there are pieces of the episode I really, really enjoyed that like were thoroughly satisfying, very well executed. As always, it was a beautiful, beautiful episode. It was amazingly shot. The sets on Kronos were incredible. And the acting was top notch. I would say the things for me that didn't work were the things that, that tied this episode to the rest of the season. So this episode, obviously, it's the finale. It's supposed to be a bookend to the rest of the season, along with the two-part premiere. But I just felt like a lot of those a lot of the ways that some of the threads of the story of the narrative were tied up didn't really work for me. So it's a double-edged sword for me. Some good things and some bad things, but. We can dive into those bit by bit, I think, throughout this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Kayla. Brian, what did you think? General reactions?
Similar to Kayla's, I thought it looked great. It sounded great. The effects were phenomenal. The set on the Orion camp on Kronos was great. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. But from a story standpoint, oh, and the cast. The cast was very good and brought their A game to the finale. But the story and the resolution of all the arcs I found very disappointing.
Disappointing.
Yeah, and we can get into, obviously, some of the details about what worked and what didn't as we continue in this podcast. What did you think of it, Jared?
Okay, so my general reaction was negative. I did not enjoy the episode. Having said that, there was one scene in this episode which evoked a more positive emotional reaction from me than anything we've seen so far in Discovery, and it was delightful.
Wow!
I don't know if you want me to go into that now, or we'll get to it when we get to it. But
does it involve a guest star?
It involves a guest star. Yes. All right. Well done. You read my mind. Matt, what do you think? Top line message.
I have to say, I have to echo what everyone else said about sort of mixed feelings about it. It was enjoyable sort of, you know, kind of overall if you didn't think about it too hard, and lots of cool action, lots of cool action and very cool sets and, you know, design. So it's kind of, you know, satisfying in that sort of popcorn kind of movie factor. But otherwise, Yeah, the more you think about it, the more I sort of have mixed feelings about parts of it that I think we all do, and we'll get into.
Can I say, and hopefully this won't come across in the wrong way, but it was not as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Oh,
agree. Okay. I had heard worse. I had heard that it is worse in the rumor mill, and I didn't hate it as much as I thought.
And well, the last two episodes were going in a direction that I was really not jiving. They wasn't really jiving with me. So I was kind of disappointed pretty much in the last two episodes, and I was really worried how they were going to. They had so much to do to make everything work in this last episode, and I was like, mm-hmm. I don't see how they can do it. I'm just really, you know, expecting mm-hmm. this to just be completely nonsensical. So it was better than what I expected.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Now, we'll get to this at some point. You have some interesting insights given your professional background that may be interesting to our listeners.
I can say what my favorite word of dialogue was in this entire series.
It was the
word phreatic. I was like, that's a real word. And they used it right, but then also didn't, so we can talk about that.
Oh, okay. Sad. Yeah.
I didn't notice that. I'm glad you're here to clarify these things for us.
Well, yeah, I heard the word phreatic, and I have no idea what that is. I hope that's correct, like used correctly. And so that's good. That's good.
Yeah, very much like tardigrade. That's the kind of word you're not going to put into a script without double-checking the Wikipedia entry or whatever, or relevant.
Wait, hopefully, yeah,
boy,
yeah.
Boy, you hope so. Yeah, you'd hope so, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think the thing we want to start with is Emperor Georgiou and her nastiness, both on the Discovery and on Kronos.
Sure, because it opens with her being quite nasty to the crew, even on the bridge.
Yeah.
Which I was surprised by this because she's acting like, excuse me, I think we get, what is it, one swear word every, or two swear words an episode or something like that? I'm gonna use mine.
Sure.
She was acting like a raging bitch. But then she gets mad at Michael and Saru for trying to out her. It's like, bitch, you outed yourself. What were you doing?
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, supposedly she's supposed to kind of keep her mouth shut and pretend she's Prime Georgiou, but man, she can't resist, right?
It's like she
can't do it.
It's like she's playing poker with her cards facing her opponents rather than herself.
Right.
Well, Brian, you just said it. You just called it. She doesn't give a shit. She knows she holds all the cards, right?
Yeah she does not care.
Why? How does she hold any cards?
Well, the admirals have given it to her. We'll talk about that. Yeah, that's not really... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kept thinking, though, about her overconfidence, the line from Undiscovered Country, first rule of assassination, kill the assassins, right?
Kill the assassins. Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, if they need you for this or whatever, it would be very easy for them to get rid of you afterwards, so maybe tone it down a little bit.
Yes,
honey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, were there any specific bits of her nastiness that stood out to people? I mean, like it seems like she's going out of her way to correct everyone's language to make it more evil than whatever they've said.
Sure, like the whole don't call it a home world because they're not worthy of a home, basically, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I know that was super hokey, but they called back to that later, and there was an aspect of that that I actually liked.
Yeah, it was set up, I agree.
I like that they called back to it. Some of the other stuff of, you know, her... And the way she did it didn't make sense to me. I didn't understand why she would be such a loudmouth. Like, she's trying to turn this world into her own world or something. And I was like, that's never going to work.
No, that made perfect sense to me because you dehumanize your enemy. That's all.
Yeah, so it's... Tactic. I actually kind of did like that one specific line. I'll say that.
I think we also learned our first Mirror Universe turn of phrase, which is scared Kelpian makes for tough Kelpian.
Yeah.
That was actually really good. Saru sass back at her too about him getting tougher. By
I love that sassy awesome. Saru.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah,
that
was good.
Oh, okay, now, but she meant it like tough, as in like the way meat can be tough, right?
Yes,
of course.
Yeah,
and then he turned it sort of back on her.
Sure,
like, you know,
yeah, because the thing it reminded me of is Pennywise the Clown, how he likes to scare the children before he eats them because scared meat tastes better. So I was wondering if they're trying to go off of that same kind of thing.
Yeah, it probably occurred to them, yeah. I mean, that it is a famous book. So
crushed all kinds of records last year with the movie.
Exactly. So maybe I could see, you could see Akiva or Aaron or Gretchen or somebody going, this is a good little, you know, turn of phrase kind of thing. Like, you could see it.
Bran, did you have any thoughts on Emperor Georgiou and her behavior?
Well, the behavior on the bridge was like almost over the top.
Yeah.
Teeth gnashing villain stuff.
Yeah.
It was kind of absurd. I kind of liked it better, the character better, once we got past the bridge scenes. I thought they were just, I thought it was just silly and pointless.
Off-putting.
Mm. Yeah, off-putting.
And it kind of Bride of Chaotica stuff, where like that kind of right. mustache twirling.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you guys your feelings about this, because a lot of people are saying, you know, the mirror universe is supposed to be this over the top mustache twirling thing, and
yeah, goatee.
Is it?
Yes. You know, it was always set up to be kind of campy, right? But
was it?
I think it's one of those things that when it first started, it was a very, very, very novel idea. And the more the franchise drilled into it, the hokier it had to become, because it is hokey, right?
Mm. I guess.
Yeah,
so.
It was a one. It was intended to be a one-off thing that kind of got, you know,
took a life on of its own.
Yeah,
it took a life of its
it's
own.
It's something
yeah.
where you can't think about it too much, right? It's kind of like,
oh yeah.
The aliens in Darmok, like, how do they write an engineering manual in metaphor, right? You kind of
right,
have to not
right.
think about that. You kind of just have to appreciate that this was an interesting story. But
sure.
by design, you know, we've had how many, like, 12, 13 episodes in the Mirror Universe now with the four
yeah.
different franchises this has touched?
Yeah.
And it's a, yeah. I think it's a little bit too much in the idea. While it's the most iconic image, for, I think, from the original series, except after maybe Kirk being in the, you know, having all the tribbles fall on him, with Spock with the goatee, I think
mm-hmm.
it's something
yeah.
that is best left in the original series.
Yeah, it was. Like I said, it was a fine one-off thing, and I have to be honest with you, most of the other Mirror Universe episodes and all the other shows I found really silly.
Yeah.
DS9, Enterprise. I know a lot of people loved the Mirror Darkly episodes of Enterprise. I thought they were stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. It's yeah, I agree. I mean, we could do a whole own thing about that, and stretching it out like this for this season. I don't think it worked.
Well,
as it could have.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
definitely.
We're going off. We're
yeah.
kind
we need
of straying
to, we need to save
off
that
topic
for
here.
Next episode.
I was going
to
yeah. say that let's put a pin in this, because I would love to talk more about the Mirror Universe, what it's supposed to be and what it was built to be in Discovery. But we're gonna next week tune in next week or whenever we. Are able to record it for our episode talking about the whole series as a whole. This, you know, this week we really just want to focus on the finale episode in particular. So,
well okay, thank you, Kale. Thanks for keeping us on track. While we're talking about Emperor Georgiou, what about her inevitable betrayal and her cunning plan to destroy Kronos? Do we want to talk about that?
You mean that thing? You mean that thing where we saw that thing that's a drone and then that's locked up, and then they zoom in on it, so we totally know that maybe this is a key thing. And then it's totally
hint,
obviously
hint,
yeah.
hint.
Gee, they're not gonna swap things, are they? Oh wait, yeah, they did.
What a twist.
I will say, before we leave Georgiou, totally, I love that when Tilly runs into her, of course she immediately, you know, initially she doesn't know, she totally thinks it's, you know, she's bought the line that it's our Georgiou back, and so of course she's all gushing and then realizes what it is. And I love that she can't, you know, just out of instinct, she starts to do the, like, mirror
the salute.
Salute to her.
Yeah.
And Burnham's
yeah,
like, no.
She goes, don't do that, yeah.
Yeah, that was cute. That was a cute
That
moment.
Was the funniest moment
yeah,
in this season.
Yeah.
Mary Wiseman with her comedic timing again. Just
yeah, it was perfect.
Killing it, yeah.
Yep, totally nailed it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the mapping, the drone, and the bomb, and the volcano sites attached to it. Now, Kayla, you do volcanoes by day and just Star Trek by night. So, can
it's
you
true.
Talk to us more about how this looked to you as a professional, as well as sort of in general from a story standpoint?
Okay. Well, I'll try not to get too deep into it, because I could talk for a long time about this, but There's two aspects of the volcano science that I think are important to both to the story and just like the scientific aspect of it. The first one is the idea that you could, like, let's assume Georgiou, what she was saying was true, and there's these extinct volcanoes all over the planet, and we're going to send a drone inside of them to map them out. So there's, it saddens me that there's this very basic lack of fundamental understanding of what volcanoes are. Mm. And that's, you know, I'm not faulting the writers here. I think that's probably more a fault on volcanologists. We need to share our science better. But science fiction writers seem to think that volcanoes are some kind of series of caverns that are interconnected inside of the Earth. And that's pretty far from the truth. You know, volcanoes, if a planet has a lot of volcanoes, they probably aren't all connected, A. And B, they're not tunnels. They're not open. They're solid, basically. You know, volcanoes come from the layer of the Earth beneath the crust called the mantle, which is a solid, a viscous, mushy solid. And when that melts, it becomes hot and buoyant, you know, like hot things rise. And so then that, mm-hmm. that melted stuff, magma, comes up to the surface and oozes out the top as a volcano. But there's no, like, there's no tunnel or path through any of these things. And also, if a volcano is extinct, you know, if there's no energy within that volcano, then, like, exploding a bomb inside of it won't do anything. It's just like exploding a bomb underneath the surface anywhere else. You know, once it cools and hardens and there's no more energy to keep the volcano alive and moving, then it's solid rock. So now you just have a column of solid rock under the surface. So just in general, the whole idea that there's this like interconnected network is not really the case. So that's sort of the first thing. And then the second thing is I'll bring up here the moment that happens a little bit later in the show where they use my favorite word of the series so far, phreatic. And I was like, hey, wow, they talked to a volcanologist or someone who knows what's up, because that's a real word. A phreatic eruption or a magmatophreatic eruption is, just like Michael said correctly, what happens when magma meets water. And when you have something that's, you know, somewhere around 1,000 degrees Celsius that comes in contact with liquid water, you can imagine that the liquid water automatically flashes to steam. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge change in volume associated with that. And so you get a big explosion, basically. You know, it's like if you put a hot poker in a bucket of water, you know, it would explode.
Because the volume changes so fast and yeah, so dramatic.
Like almost instantaneously, like catastrophically. There's this huge increase in volume. And so it pushes everything else out of the way. So you get a big explosion. But that's, you know, that typically happens. Like if a volcano erupts underwater, like say in a lake or something like that, you can get a phreatic eruption. Or if a volcano magma is coming towards the surface and it intersects the water table, which is sitting under the surface, then that can have a big explosion. But then the next step where they say, oh, so if she blows this up because it's a hydro bomb, I guess, means it has something to do with water. We're going to blow up like a water bomb?
Yeah.
That was so unclear
That was the way I understood it.
So we're going to put like a bomb of water somehow in there, and then we're going to make this big explosion, and then it will destroy the Earth. That's where it, like, that is where it went off the rails. Or destroy Kronos rather, not the Earth.
Lowercase.
Exactly. Thank you. So I was very pleased that they used the word phreatic and then put like the dictionary definition of it immediately after. I was like, woohoo, volcanology in action. But but then it actually made no sense in terms of like actual nature and what would happen. And a phreatic eruption isn't a particularly energetic eruption. I mean, it's explosive, you know, it goes boom. It's like a flash bang, but it's not like, you know, like a pyroclastic flow or a big, you know, like Vesuvius or something like that you think of. Those are much more energetic. Mm-hmm. So
I see the
idea that you could blow up a planet or destroy a planet's surface by putting some water inside of a volcano? Not really.
Is this as bad as the cold fusion?
Yeah. That might be worse, right?
No, it can't be as bad.
I feel like it's not as bad. The cold fusion makes less sense, I think.
Yeah.
Well, and because cold fusion doesn't mean it makes things cold, right?
No.
Right?
Yeah, that too. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that too.
All right. We don't have to go off topic too much, but I just wanted to make that quick aside since it was once again a volcano.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that is on theme. That is definitely
I like that a volcano has been a Star Trek MacGuffin more than once. That makes me very happy.
You know what's funny about volcanoes is it seems Gene Roddenberry sort of got obsessed with them at a certain point because he wanted them worked into TAS as much as he could. Because then you just you animate it, right? And it's free. There's no special effect for it. He got really interested into it. And apparently in various meetings, he was always telling them, like, they should go to a planet and there's a volcano. You know, it's like, okay. I guess this obsession with volcanoes has sort of quietly been there since, well, the early 70s, really.
I love it. So. That's amazing. I never knew that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So something that bugs me with volcanoes are depicted in media is the idea that it's only hot if you touch the lava. When in truth, you know, that's kind of like Super Mario Brothers physics right there. When in truth, if something is hot enough. Thank you. If something's hot enough to turn rock, you know, to melt rock, then it is just radiating heat everywhere. And if you're anywhere near close to it, it's going to burn you.
True. Yes.
Anyway, that's just something to know.
Yeah. Me.
Great summary, Kayla. Thank you for lending your expertise to the good Children of Trek movie.
Of course. I hope it was. I hope it was clear.
It was.
Oh, yeah, totally. Very
It certainly was. Very absolutely.
Yeah.
So while we're on Kronos, let's talk a little about the kind of Orion ghetto. Because, Brian, you mentioned that you thought that was kind of cool to see that.
Yeah, it was a great set piece. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a little weird to have an Orion village / ghetto / whatever in the middle of the Klingon homeworld.
Agreed. That was weird.
I did too, but I think it... Who pointed out... that maybe it was in a comment I read online, I can't remember if one of you said it, that it makes sense because there is this like religious faction, right, that exists around that shrine or whatever it was they were looking for. So by putting the Orion village on top of that, was it you that was telling us?
No, that's actually our founder and review and the guy who wrote our review, Tony's headcanon, basically, for this. I think he put it together kind of nicely, because there's really no explanation for it except for this, which is that it's Molor who, of course, fell to Kalis. Kalis won over him and his side.
Yeah, you know, that was a good continuity touch. That mentioned
right. Molor. So if you're going to suppress these people who might still sort of believe in the not Kalis, right, like the other person who was slaughtered, and really Kalis is your preferred, you know, warrior deity type person. Well, how better than to kind of just suppress that than let Orions have a ghetto all over one of their shrines, you know? So credit to Tony. That was his kind of headcanon of why that would make sense.
Oh, that's good.
Okay.
Like sadly, that was not written anywhere. They should have, see, that's the kind of stuff they should have talked about.
But yeah, that's the stuff they can put in the novelization.
or the comic book. Or
Yeah, comic book.
Now, what I would have liked to have seen, and which I think would have allowed time for kind of that stuff, is if this mission had been more than half an episode, right? I mean, the idea of sneaking onto your main enemy's home world and having cool adventures there, that should be like a three-parter, right?
Oh, yeah.
Two-parter,
I think the war was over and done with, and everyone was commended in like 33 minutes or so.
Yeah.
38. Yeah. It was 38 minutes.
There you go, 38 minutes. And it's like, including what? Intro. Okay.
Yep.
There you go. Kind of hasty, but yeah. I agree. We really should have seen more of this.
Well, and all of us, and you know, a lot of people online that I've been chatting, friends of mine have been watching, we're all thinking, oh, I wonder if they're going to do the full hour. They're definitely going to at least use up the 60 minutes. How great if we got like an hour and 20 for the finale? Yes. And it was what, 44?
It should have been a 90 minute. Yeah, it was the 45. Typical. Yeah, it was the typical length they've been doing. It totally should have been 90 minutes or something.
Yeah. I felt like there's a lot more they could have done. Although I must say that I don't think that the problems in this episode were because of a lack of time.
Correct.
Yeah,
but,
well said.
I agree with that.
Well
said.
But still, I would have liked to have seen a longer episode.
Yes.
Yeah, for it to have been a little bit more involved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now Tilly has some fun adventures when she's in this Orion village, doesn't she?
Tilly is life.
Yeah.
If you mean by fun, accidentally eating innocent space whale, yes.
So, do we assume that the Gormagander that she ate was the same one we had just seen? Because they're apparently exceedingly rare.
Oh no! I hope not. Because weren't they supposed to relocate that one to a safe place, they said?
Did they?
That's the regulations. Saru repeats that to Lorca, remember, 20 times over, and Lorca rolls his eyes every time.
Yeah, I know, but do they ever actually do it? Because then...
Well, the episode ends, we don't know. Right. In theory, right? They did their job, who knows?
I don't know, I think it's maybe the same one.
Lorca kicked it out an airlock, and somebody picked it up, you know?
Yeah.
Yikes! They're endangered, people, come on. So yeah, Tilly had endangered meat. Well, not really, she spat it out, but yikes.
Yeah, she was undercover.
That's what you get for not asking what something is before you eat it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, you definitely want to ask.
Look before you eat. Now, and Tilly had some cool adventures while she was there in terms of meeting a familiar face. Brian, can you tell us what happened with that?
Yeah, all of a sudden, this more elderly Orion fellow tries to sell her. What was he trying to sell her? I forget.
Volcano smoke,
right, which is clearly has like some sort of maybe hallucinogenic property or narcotic properties attached to it. And that Orion was played by none other than Clint Howard, whom everyone probably remembers as being Balok in the Corbomite maneuver in the original series.
The Tranya guy. That's right.
Yeah, the Tranya boy.
Tranya.
I hope you enjoy it as much as I.
This was the scene that I just loved. I was so delighted to see him there.
Yeah.
Because
I think he had a bowl of Tranya right next to him too. They had some sort of orange type.
Yeah, I think the prop guys did it. I think they did. I think they worked it in. So kudos to them.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, he was a delight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen him at conventions before, and this is a guy who's done a lot more, and of course his association with his brother Ron Howard, he's done a lot of cameos and stuff because of him, and he's had a big career. This is, you know, if not where it started with Star Trek, one of the first gigs he had, and he comes to conventions, and people are happy to see him, but he doesn't have a lot really to talk about, right? How many times has he told the story, the Tranya's grapefruit juice, right? There's only so many things he could say because it was like six when it happened. And it's a tiny little scene. Right. So I'm happy that he now is going to have some other stuff to talk about at conventions.
Yeah.
Yep.
He was also a Ferengi in Enterprise. So he's been used a few times here and there. That's right.
I forgot. Oh, man. We need to do that Enterprise episode we've been talking about for the last 2 years. So you can share all these anecdotes with me that I should know, Matt.
And Clint Howard is one of several kind of fan servicey things that happen in that village. There's City Alpha Eels. Yes.
They can't be City Eels. They can't be. They have to be something that just looks like City Eels.
Why not? Someone could have picked them up.
They're City Eels from a gangster planet instead of a desert planet.
I thought, but like, didn't like Khan and his group discover them?
No, I think they were native to the planet.
I think they figured out that they suck, that they were native to this planet, and boy, did they suck to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah, they found out the hard way what they were all about. Yeah. That's the impression I got.
I always assumed that they weren't really known about outside, you know, because no one really knew much about that planet even. They didn't even know that the one planet was gone.
That's a whole other weird science.
Well, no, that planet hasn't exploded yet, don't forget.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, like, no one's really paying too much attention to this whole planetary system.
No, of course.
Sure, but the Orions are pillagers and scroungers and merchants. Right, they could be. Yeah. You know, you can kind of...
And the people who wrote the episode just put them in there.
Well, that's what it is. So, in my headcanon is that it is... cyan milk, and it's not actually Seti eels. They just look like Seti eels.
Okay, sure. I buy into that completely.
Let's be fair. A whole lot of freaky bugs look similar anyway.
Right.
The various beetles look similar. Various whatever, you know.
Can we please talk about the double Klingon dong?
Oh, yes. Someone had to say it. Double shocker, everybody.
The double shocker.
Yeah. That's an Orange is the New Black reference for everybody.
What do we want to say about the Klingon Wang?
I have to say, there's been a lot of debate between a lot of people, including myself on Twitter, including Jordan Hoffman and some other friends of mine, about what actually was happening in that scene. Because you see, like, what could be... two streams or one bifurcated stream.
Correct.
But I would posit that it is supposed to be two penises because there's this whole callback to the Klingons always having having redundant organs. Yeah. Which is from the TNG episode. So I think the first time that it's established, like that some of the organs are doubled, I think was in that episode in Ethics.
Yeah. Yes. Ethics, where Worf breaks his spine.
I think I'm pretty sure that's the earliest mention of that. And then
It is.
But as far as I'm aware, and I asked Larry Nemechek about this just to be doubly sure that it's not in some, you know, Starfleet medical reference or something. I'm pretty sure that Discovery gets another first for Star Trek, which is to make canon that there is a double excretory system, double liquid excretory system in Klingons.
It's true. It has never been canon before.
So
never
Star Trek history, people. You're watching it happen.
Yep.
Did we need to watch this happen, or was this perhaps a little tasteless?
Oh, this was totally somebody thought it would be neat. It's not good. Whatever. Yeah, who cares? Yeah. We didn't need it at all.
It seemed like more of a Orville type of thing, right? That kind of gag.
Could be. Yeah.
You know? Anyway.
Well, anyway, they have redundant organs. Get it? Yeah, we got it.
Yep. Get it? Like, yep. Did you get that?
Did you get it, you guys? Like, yes, we got it. Thank
remember?
You.
Remember how they have redundant organs? Do you remember that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's another bit of fan service where the Emperor drops the name of a TOS episode.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything was going so well.
Yeah, and in that scene. Stood out so badly. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's like, oh, come on. And you know what it is? They didn't even use it properly.
No, they didn't. Not at all.
It's not even being used in the right context. Because they're having these fun little moments where, you know, Tilly's eating whale meat and all this other silly stuff. And then she comes over and she's like, enough with the bread and circuses.
Yeah.
Which to me means, you know, enough with the foolishness.
Yeah, because the whole idea of bread and circuses was that was how the ancient Roman government kept their people docile, right? It was with food and food and entertainment. So it's like distraction is the idea.
Right. I just thought that was not really applied properly.
No, yeah, not at all.
It just completely stood out.
Yeah. It has a more nuanced meaning than the way that it was used.
Exactly. It almost works, but not quite.
But also, it's just so shoehorned in, and like the rest, sucked me right out of the story. I have to admit at that point.
She should have winked at the screen. You know, it's like wink. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we know. We get it.
It should have been like da 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 da.
If this were Family Guy, they should have cut away to something. You know, and been like. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, they would have cut away to the episode.
Exactly, and then cut back and been like, see?
Right. Anyway, Remember Star Trek, you guys?
Yeah.
Remember that time they were like Romans and stuff? Yeah.
Which I think the reason they did that is because they're trying to show that like the mirror universe is like Roman inspired, like with her title is very Roman, and the whole salute thing, that's like a Roman salute.
That is a good point.
Right. They're trying. It's totally a connection to it.
I was just like,
it's a connection to it, but it's still poor. Yeah.
Yeah, it's still kind of lousy.
Yeah.
I really liked the rest of that scene, I have to say. And when they threw that in there, I was like, okay.
Yeah, I enjoyed the rest of the scene too. It was a series of fun little moments.
Yeah, it was all good.
All right, here's for our fans at home or at work, wherever you may be listening to this. What other TOS episode would it have been better to name drop there instead of Bread and Circuses? Put it in the comment section below or tweet us at Trek Movie.
I thought maybe you had an answer for that, Jared. I was waiting. I was like,
yeah, so did I.
Oh, of course. If I could have had them name drop something, it would have been Requiem for Methuselah.
No, interesting.
That's a joke, just because it wouldn't fit at all. I was trying.
How does that apply?
I was being polite.
Yeah,
but
no.
Fantastic.
I was not being polite. There's no, wouldn't have, it would have made just as much, it would have been just as nonsensical.
So they could have said, like, shore leave, wink, wink. You know?
Yeah. Or,
or now that everyone has had a piece of the action.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah. Nicely done.
That actually would have been better. No, that would have been good.
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or while we are trapped, like, in this... Sorry.
No, we would have been like, oh, I think that was a name drop, even though it was just fit in so well.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Or maybe we're not here on an errand of mercy. Right?
That ooh, bam. Nicely done.
Yeah.
And that one's a Klingon twofer, because that really is about another Klingon episode.
Mic drop. Hire us. Boom.
Exactly. Jared with the winning. Boom.
There were several better options than that, but that's, but you know, there we are. She was, Tilly was eating food, so it's connection there. So how much do we want to talk about the Game of Thrones scene with Emperor Georgiou?
I'd just like to say that not every bisexual person is evil, and vice versa.
Yeah, and that's a trip. The fact they found it on
okay.
It is.
I found it on TV Tropes.
Yeah.
I found it on TV Tropes, and they officially call it the depraved bisexual trope.
Yeah.
It really has, and it has become one, and it's kind of ridiculous.
So, oh well. I guess that's kind of following on from the, like, the Kira, the major Kira mirror universe thing. Yeah. But, you know, just throwing that out there. That was my reaction to that scene.
My reaction was just they're trying to make it more Game of Thronesy than Star Trek needs to be.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Or their idea of making it edgy. That's all.
Yeah.
Edgy.
Gritty. It's very, gritty.
It's not even very good.
Yeah, right.
Edgy.
Gritty. Right. Yeah. Gritty. That's right. Gritty.
Yeah.
That's oh, the
yes. Word they
gritty's
kept
our
using.
Buzzword. Yeah. Yeah. Gritty's the buzzword.
It kind of just underscores one of my overarching reactions to this is that this is not a show where I'm excited to want to, like, show this to my nephews and nieces the way I am with everything else from Star Trek.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would definitely not show Discovery to a kid. No
yeah.
way.
No. Yeah. I don't know what they do with it. Anyway, but we can drill down on that more later. Okay, so everybody's human Klingon hybrid. Everybody's favorite human Klingon hybrid. We want to talk a little bit about the Tyler and the Burnham stuff.
Yes.
Kayla, what do you want to say? What have you got?
Well, there's a lot here. I think I just think ever since they killed Vok, or Voke, I guess it's Voke now. It was Vok for the first half of the season, and now it's Voke. But
yeah,
I guess
they somehow switched it.
Tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
I guess they killed Voke. Ever since they did that, I've been kind of confused about what the point of this whole storyline was.
I think they've been confused too. I don't think they know what to do now.
Yeah.
I like the character of Ash Tyler. I like the Tyler Burnham romance. I really do like that. But when they, you know, had him be this 50-50 hybrid, and then the solution to that was just to kill off a half of him, which was actually his original person. I mean, this is Voke's body.
Mm.
Right.
That they've demented and then put Tyler's consciousness into, but now he gets to be Tyler, and you know, are his memories even real? They're just implanted. So I don't know. There's just so many questions about the whole thing. I don't think it ended up super satisfyingly. I thought that the scenes between Tyler and Burnham were great. Actually, I thought the with Sonequa Martin-Green as Michael talking about, you know, what happened to her parents as she was a child, I thought that was really nice. I thought that was a really cool way to add to her backstory a bit. So I thought that was a really nice piece of writing.
Yeah, they continue to have really good chemistry, the two actors.
They do, sure. Yeah. But, and then, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself a bit here, I guess, but, you know, Tyler leaves at the end of the episode, and I guess I don't know if I'm going to talk about that now, but it was confusing.
Well, yeah, we could just sort of jump into that. Yeah. This is what frustrates me, is that he was supposed... We've talked about this on the podcast, that he, like, this Vokler person, would actually be the perfect person to figure out peace, because he sees both sides, right? We've talked about this very idea,
yeah.
And then they didn't do anything with it, And then at the very end of this episode, they pay a little bit of lip service to it. And he's like, yeah, I can see both sides, so it totally makes sense for me to go with Laurel and help her. Okay? But, like, talk about wasted, you know, well, real wasted solid stuff there.
Though. I guess the only way it did pay off was in Burnham, which didn't really follow through to the larger solution, I didn't think. But I think they wanted it to, but I don't think it did. But they had him say to her, you know, I can see both sides, literally. And because she's, this is what I liked, was that callback to, oh, don't call it a home planet. And Michael's looking out at these people. She's like, I just see people living their life. You know, I just see, you know, people going about their day. And if this is their home, it's all about to be destroyed. And Tyler sort of just reiterates that to her, saying, yes, I agree, and I can see both sides, literally, which was, I don't know, I thought that was kind of nice. I don't think that, I don't think that his feelings told Michael something she didn't already know, because she'd already figured out for herself, look, these are people, these are just the same as humans. They're just people living their lives, and they're innocent. So she already had seen, you know, learned to see the other, air quotes, happening right now. So his unique perspective didn't necessarily help her on that journey. It was just reinforcing it. And then the idea was for her to go and then take this idea, this, you know, epiphany she had, oh, Klingons are just people, and then make this solution at the end. But the solution was so nonsensical that it didn't work.
What did we think about the exchange where Burnham explains to him that her parents were brutally murdered by Klingons?
I mean, we knew that, basically, right? But just, we didn't know the details.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a question about the story she tells. She says that, you know, the Klingons are busting down the door. Her mom put her in a cupboard, closes it, and she hears the entire thing happen. And she then hears the Klingons sit down at the table and eat and laugh and have a grand old time. Now, they were about to sit down and eat dinner, right?
Yeah.
They killed two people. There were probably three place settings at the table. Don't you think they would be like,
Yeah.
Where's the third person?
Yeah, sort of a Goldilocks and the Three Bears type of thing.
Maybe they hadn't put the plates out yet, but the meal was on the table. Or it was like in the pot on the stove next to the table. No, that didn't bother me.
Yeah, it's a decent point. Yeah.
I think some Klingons are pretty freaking dumb. Like, let's get real. I don't think...
Some are. Yeah, they've shown some pretty dumb ones.
I think it's certainly believable that they would have totally missed her. I don't know.
Yeah, because they feel pretty good. They just gutted two humans, and they're drunk on some blood wine or something, and they're just pillaging, right? Like, whatever. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know. It's a little iffy, but it could be.
Yeah, like, let's be honest, they were probably drunk.
Right.
Probably.
Oh, I didn't have a problem with it. I kind of liked it.
The part that struck me is it seems like that, you know, being a firsthand witness to that level of brutality, I think would have made Burnham a little angrier at the Klingons than we've ever seen her to be. That was my reaction.
I think that's maybe the Vulcan side, though, where she was sort of conditioned
to suppress
that aside. Because you see that flashback where she actually can't handle being asked a question. Mm-hmm. There's like a trivia question in the little training bowl about her outpost.
The training bull.
You know, and she can't do it. She actually has a moment and looks up at Sarek for like guidance, and like he's just like, why are you being a human about this? You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Because I am douchebag. Why does he want her to be such a Vulcan all the time? Like, she's literally not a Vulcan.
Because he knows nothing else.
Whatever. Well, that's not very enlightened of him.
I know.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that too. Sarek pretty soon here.
Okay, let's see. While we're on the subject of Tyler and Voke, do we want to talk about Laurel?
Yeah.
The builder of bridges.
That's what she's called herself before. So I think that's interesting. And it's nice that they, although poorly used that idea, at least they used that idea that they had talked about before with her. And here she is, like, being this unifier, although it's poorly done.
So she's given the hydro bomb by Giorgio.
Yeah.
And she basically goes in front of all the Klingons and says, I'm taking over or I'm going to blow the entire fucking thing up.
Yes. And so let's talk about that. Is that honorable? I don't know if that's really considered honorable to Klingons. That seems like a kind of...
Also, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, sure. That's for sure.
And it seems unsustainable, right?
Yes, exactly. Because then what, right? Like, then what? And why can't they just, you know, shoot her and then destroy the detonator?
Yeah, exactly. Or, exactly.
Or beam it out of her hands.
So you're... Or that. Like, put yourself in their shoes. You're a Klingon. You're some, you know, big wig in the Klingon, with big Klingon house. You're having your tea party or whatever in the Klingon Senate or whatever the hell they were. Mrs. Nobody comes in and goes, you will all bow down to me now because I have a bomb.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, yeah. Kill her. Just
you
just
go, lol, and then right you phaser there. Her ass. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Just disintegrated. Done. We're done with this crap.
You like, know? Why? It made... Okay. I have to say, there were two moments in this. The reason I know... earlier in the episode, Matt, I said that it was 38 minutes to wrap everything up. The reason I know that number is because I looked at the timestamp a couple of times and I paused it because I was laughing so darn hard. One of them was the moment when Michael convinces Giorgio to not blow up the bomb, which was kind of easy, but you know what? Kind of frankly believable the way it played out, but it was a little easy. But then she goes, oh, do you want me to code it to your biosignature? And she goes, not to mine, and like steps aside, and you're waiting. you're like, who's gonna come in? Because that's who she wants to encode it to. And then Laurel walks in full armor, and I was just like, what? What are they get? Because I knew there's no. I'm you know running through the scenarios in my head. I'm like, there's nothing that's going to make sense. And so they do it, and I'm just watching with my mouth open. And then they do this scene in the Senate with Laurel claiming, I am now your leader. And they all go, okay, I guess so. And then the
they laugh at her first, and then she shows her bomb.
And they go, okay, you're right, I guess so, you know, no hard feelings. And then they do that shot, that shot of the Earth with all the Klingon ships coming towards the Earth, and they're just like, JK, LOL.
Forget it. Yeah.
And they just turn around, and I just started laughing.
Yeah. Why the hell would they do that?
That makes zero sense.
I don't think laughter was the reaction they wanted to evoke.
No.
Well, it was the funniest moment of the episode for me.
And it doesn't make any sense either to Laurel, who has at least been very proud to be Klingon. So, like, okay, maybe she, you know, forces them to unify the houses under her rule, but, like, wouldn't she be like, keep going, we're almost
like
done.
Like, still,
you know,
blow up Earth, though.
Right.
You literally almost won the war.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, let's just finish this thing for our, you know, proud race. We're done here.
They were literally, like, right in Earth orbit when they turned around.
It made no sense.
You could see the Earth.
Yeah, you could see the Earth.
Yeah.
You're like,
Hey, there's an episode of Deep Space Nine where the Breen attack Earth, and General Martok says, even my people were never so bold as to try this.
Yes, thank you. I was going to bring that up. Thank you, Jared.
Right.
So they basically did, though.
Matt and I talked about this before.
Kayla and I had a debate about this. Yeah.
I still think it makes sense because they didn't actually try to attack the Earth because they decided
they
to turn around.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, so they weren't stopped.
Still, I would think there would be like perimeter guards. Like, there's the Mars defense line that we see both in Enterprise and in Best of Both Worlds. And presumably, there's some kind of defense in the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt or whatever it is.
Kuiper belt.
So, thank you.
Kuiper belt.
Thank you. Yeah.
The Kuiper belt sounds like the Kuiper belt. Sorry.
Yeah, it does. That's what I thought of, too. I was like, oh, man, that's something else.
That's a whole other conversation.
That's something that Emperor Giorgio was teaching
the Emperor
those
Giorgio
guys.
With the Orions. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So yes, the asteroid belt and all that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't mean to nerd it up with that. It's just.
But it doesn't. You're right. It doesn't make any sense at all. Yeah.
Nothing about that. Nothing about the resolution to this season makes any kind of sense.
No.
No. It's like unbelievably hasty and thrown together.
It's so hasty.
They just hope like hell you'll buy it.
And I mean, like, that's the thing. Watching it, you kind of do buy it. Like, oh, it's good acting. Like, oh, this seems cool. And then you're like, no.
And again, the production values are terrific. I love that scene where they, like, zoom into Earth, right? I thought that looked so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effects in this episode were excellent.
Excellent.
And creatively done. Like, they designed them really well.
So before we leave this cave, there's one other thing I wanted to bring up. Because we had sort of... dropped Emperor Giorgio, but and just like they do, they pretty much just drop Emperor Giorgio and leave her alone. So what? They hand off the detonator to Laurel, and Burnham looks over at the Emperor and goes, "Yeah, be good, Philippa," and she like takes off. What?
Be good.
Yeah, like she's not gonna walk out of that cave and go do something really screwed up like right away.
So hi, we'll see her next season somehow. Cool.
Wow.
Like, yes, I know they claim to have given her freedom, but this goes back to that whole thing that we're talking about of, you need to, she needs to die. Like, she shouldn't be around.
Or, right? Like, in she's prison.
She's a genocidal tyrant. Like, sorry, that's not the kind of person you just let wander around your universe.
Yeah, because what if she decided to switch sides and say to the Klingons, hey, you know, I have all the tactical knowledge of these enemies. Would you like to give me a job, right? She's a threat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hey, I have slightly advanced knowledge from a starship that's 10 years ahead of you, slipping back 100 years that we've reverse engineered. Hey, would you like some of that? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, dude, you have so many problems with that. Yeah. Anyway, so there you go. That's not so great. I will say, though, to the other people that we think will be reoccurring, despite the plot issues, I do like that Laurel and Tyler are going to be around and probably reoccur a little bit in season two, because the actors certainly...
They are fantastic, see more of them. Yes.
Exactly. I'd like to see more of them.
Yeah, they were good.
Laurel is an interesting character, so I'd like to see more of her. I mean, yes, they didn't use her well, but I'd like to see more of her. So that's good, you know, overall.
The Laurel and Cornwell scenes have been some of my favorite.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, they were good.
Can I have a rant I kind of want to go on about Cornwell? Is it okay
if I
use that? Go for it. Pivot? We just brought her up. Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. And I talked with you guys a little bit about this before we started filming. But Star Trek, by necessity, has always kind of had an admiral problem, right? In order for the captain to be the hero, or in this case, specialist later, Lieutenant Commander Burnham. For them to be the hero, the admiral can't really be their boss, right? So we always need to have the admirals be a little helpless or dumb or just out of touch or disinterested in some ways and just say, well, I'll back whatever you decide, Jean-Luc. And then on the other end, we need to have the admirals be like actual traitors, right? Because then, or otherwise, so that the heroes can like stand up to them and defy their orders, right?
Like Admiral Dougherty.
Dougherty, sure, that's a great example.
How many people until it's wrong?
Yeah, Admiral Cartwright, he turned out to be a traitor.
Cartwright.
Of course, there were some evil admirals in conspiracy, and they were being mind controlled, but still evil. Admiral Nechayev was always kind of a jerk, although I actually kind of like that because sometimes, you know, the boss just needs to be a tough boss. So I actually
Nechayev is great.
And she wasn't actually evil. She was just a hard ass.
You need to be. You need to be.
Right.
And something that I liked about Admiral Cornwell is she was in that same vein where she seemed like believably tough and authoritative to have risen to the rank of admiral in a military or quasi-military organization. So I really liked that. And I like that they were able to kind of defy this long-standing trope of always having to have the admirals be bad in some way, right? And then here, at the last minute, they'd almost made it the whole season, and then they say, oh, the admiral is making us do things that's against our values, so we have to stand up to them. And if a mutiny started this war, a mutiny's going to end it. And I'm like, wait, no, that's the wrong message. Burnham needs to be like repentant from her mutiny, because again,
bookending. I think they're really clever.
It's superficially works on from a storytelling level, but only superficially. Okay. Then the other thing is, it's been established that the Klingons are about to destroy everything, and here's our chance to sort of I think Garak says this in one episode: chop off the snake's head, and the body will die. Right. To have this weapon of mass destruction in Kronos. And they have to do like the kind of this Star Trek we must but we must not dilemma type of thing where we're too good for this, we're not going to sink to their level. And it's like, I can understand if you're talking about things like, you know, we don't want to torture the tardigrade, we're going to find a better way to do this. Okay, I'm on board with that. But here, where you're facing an existential threat, like, I think it's a disservice to the people you're supposed to protect. It's saying, no, we're not going to kill these Klingons before they kill you. And so I always kind of have issues when they do that kind of thing. And there's this beautiful episode of Deep Space Nine called Rocks and Shoals, where, and I just rewatched it today, where and we can play a clip from it. The Jem'Hadar have been ordered to come kill our heroes, but the Vorta has given them the opportunity to betray them so that they can kill the Jem'Hadar, sort of sneak attack the Jem'Hadar. So the heroes to survive have to do something sneaky. That's the setup.
And when they reach this point, we'll have them in a crossfire.
They won't have a chance.
Now that is the point. In case you've forgotten, we're in a war.
So we just shoot them down.
They wouldn't hesitate if the situation was reversed.
But we're not the Jem'Hadar. It is our duty to...
This isn't a vote! The decision's mine. Mr. Garrick is right. We are at war. Given the choice between us and them, there is no choice.
Okay, so I really love that we have in there Nog, who's just from the Academy, and so his head is full of all this kind of Starfleet indoctrination, that Captain Sisko interrupts him to say, in the choice between them and us, there is no choice. And I really wanted somebody to say that in this episode, because if we have to choose between killing the Klingons or letting them kill us, that seems like a pretty easy choice. So we had two like kind of Star Trek cliches that were going on here, and which had been kind of avoided or circumvented in other cases, like say with Admiral Nechayev subverting that the Admiral needs to be evil, or here with this Deep Space Nine episode. And instead they fell into the trap and they did both of these cliches. And it just drove me bonkers. And then her like big sermon that she gives on the bridge, it seemed really unnecessary and unearned. And then they did another big speech at the end, and I'm like, okay, the hero wants to give her speech, that's great, but let's just do one in an episode. So this whole scene, everything about this just drove me crazy. So thank you for listening to my rant and my clip from Deep Space Nine. This concludes my report.
End rant.
Thank you. Close hashtag.
That does go back to one of the things that we brought up recently, which is that the writers don't seem to understand that Starfleet isn't a pacifist organization, right? Like, that goes back to the thing where, oh, we needed to have the Emperor come and show us how, the evil Emperor, show us how it's done.
Yeah.
And it's like, right, except for when pushed, when, you know, when Starfleet is pushed, they respond, and we've seen it time and again. So, why is this a surprise? Why do we need to go this direction? You know what I mean? It's like, all right. So it's all sort of a symptom of that, I think.
I agree.
They don't think it should be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Where it's just a little bit off.
Right.
Or quite a bit off, I would say. Anyway, while we're talking about the big speech, do we want to talk about her the scene at the end? I know a lot of people like that perhaps more knighted, or do we want to talk about Sarek's involvement at the end of the episode?
Let's talk about Sarek.
Okay.
Yeah, we should talk about Sarek for sure.
Okay, Kayla.
He pins her.
Kayla, what do you want to say about Sarek? And then, Brian, I know you had some thoughts on this, too. Some very pointed thoughts.
I think, Brian, I'm going to let you go ahead, because I think I'm just going to step on what you have to say. So,
The way the character behaves throughout Discovery, but particularly in this episode, I feel like is so out of character and really contradicts who he is later on. He's emotional. He smiles.
Yep. That's really weird. He should not smile.
Which is
at all.
Very weird. And he says things and behaves in...
I agree.
All of a sudden, he's like getting involved in like military tactics.
Yeah, which he's always been against. He's always been a Vulcan ambassador, someone who's outside of Starfleet. In the Federation, but outside of Starfleet.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
But he's like working
and wants
them.
To be there. Right.
In this.
Right.
And he's it's bizarre.
Yeah, I found it very weird. And then he's part of the group along with Cornwell that is advocating for the genocide of the Klingon homeworld.
Yes, and that is something that makes no sense modern Vulcans. I feel like
modern Vulcans. Sarek,
I feel like they forgot and made Sarek like an Enterprise Vulcan. Like they reverted him like 100 years in their culture. And it's like, no, that's exactly what in season 4, that's exactly what they start to move away from. In season 4 of Enterprise, they start to move away from the sort of a-hole Vulcans and into the more logical, careful, pacifist-like Vulcans that we know them to be by
the original series. And I think that's the idea that Sarek is complicit in the genocide is symptomatic of what I feel is the biggest problem with the way that this season and this episode was resolved, which is, and we've talked about this in past podcasts, and we were kind of saying, I hope they don't do this, and this is exactly what they did. They showed us the mirror universe, and then they had Giorgio come into our universe, and Giorgio was the don't be like her, but, yeah. And so Giorgio wants to genocide, you know, an entire species. She wants to completely wipe out all Klingons, but we didn't. Because we're better than that. Because we are Starfleet. We don't do genocide. Right. It's like, okay, right. But you know what? Good first step. I agree with that. But like, we are Starfleet and we don't commit genocide.
That's a low bar, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, okay.
Like when someone says to me, what are the ideals of Starfleet? I'm you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is obviously, well, A, no genocide. That's right out. No, I mean, you know what I mean? It's supposed to be
right, like
this just
like that's unspoken because no shit, of course right. not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It's like, you know, what makes a good person? Well, A, you don't kill babies. That's a number one.
Right.
You don't want to be a mass murderer, it's
right?
cool.
That's a bad Yeah. So it's this idea that we are, look how good Starfleet is because we didn't commit genocide. It's like, congratulations. Like, do you want a prize?
Yeah.
That's been pointed out before by other people, and they're right. It's a logical fallacy, basically.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, well, this is terrible. So ergo, we are not terrible. And it's like, no. It's just less terrible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we're.
Yeah. And then, you know, Sarek tells her after she gets her rank back, he tells her, I am not alone in finding your commitments to Starfleet ideals commendable.
Right, and he should never have been involved in that in the first place. Because in theory, he doesn't like Starfleet.
Yeah. Right, and there are at least two examples in Journey to Babel where it is made very clear that Sarek has very little use for Starfleet. He accepts that they exist and that they need to be part of the Federation, but he doesn't particularly approve of them.
Right, which is one of the reasons why he's estranged from Spock for all this time. Like, come on. Right,
is it possible? Yeah. Can I just put this out there and you tell me if I'm wrong? But is it possible that he says that at that time because he's sort of, salty that Spock went against his wishes and joined Starfleet instead of the Vulcan Science Academy? That he's sort of like, well, you know, like now he's sort of mad at Starfleet, but it's really that he just has issues with his son?
Mm. I mean, now that's kind of how it looks now, retroactively.
Right, retroactively looking back, like, is that a way to make it make sense?
I guess so, but that, again, makes Sarah quite a little bitch again.
Well, yeah.
That's not a fun
Well, he didn't speak to his son for how many years? He's a jerk in any of them.
Yeah, sure, he is a jerk, but I mean, there's this weird Vulcan sort of ego and pride that they don't like to talk about there, and you can almost, like, you know, you kind of understand it through that lens, but then to make him just outright just flat out just jerk who will talk to his adopted daughter but won't his son, like, I don't know.
Yeah, does that make any sense?
It gets iffy, you know what I mean? It's like, okay, what?
Well, but his adopted daughter is human. I don't know. I know that, you know, like for example, Brian, I know you didn't like that necessarily addition to the canon from Lethe, the story of her and Spock and the whole thing in the past, but that just really worked for me.
I liked it. Yeah.
So if that's,
I thought it turns Sarek into a total asshole.
I think it makes him flawed.
Mm, it's more like protecting the family reputation or something. I don't know. There's something to it, but yeah.
I think he admitted though that he made a mistake.
Yeah, he's guilty about it. That's
right.
Actually what's
right. Yeah,
about.
He's hanging on. That was the point, right? Was that he was hanging on to his guilt from having done that to her, and that was his dying like regret. But that's fine, you know, if it doesn't work for some people, it doesn't work for some people. I'm not trying to force
that. Either way though, it's pretty clear that Sarek is quite a bit different in attitude about a lot of things. War.
Agreed. Oh, 100% agreed.
Like, that's just odd. It's just odd.
I totally agree. Yeah, it was very out of character.
Yeah. Like I said, I feel like they decided to reach back and decide that Sarek behaved like an 100-year prior Vulcan. You know what I mean? Like 100 years ago. The old culture that was sort of shown. And it's like, what? No. Come on. I don't think it's purposeful, but that's the only thing I got. You know what I mean? It's the only way to explain it. It's like, what?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I'm not meaning to undermine what you were saying there on its face. I also felt that Sarek's actions didn't make any sense to me. And it started, of course, in whatever, one or two episodes back with his, we talked about this before, you know, when he busts onto the bridge with Cornwell and then just goes ahead and sticks his fingers in Saru's mind.
Yeah, he's their little psychic, you know, tool. Like, what?
Like, that's not moral. That's not okay at all.
Well, and of course, what we know about mind melds is that they're personal, they're intensely, you know, they're intense, like they're not something to be done lightly.
Right.
But here they're just throwing it around left and right, you know, like, okay, just do it, go for it, like, whatever.
All right, well, let's get to the celebration in Paris. If you could sum up this scene in one word, friends, what would that word be?
Oh, man. Can I use a phrase which is go look at the end of Star Trek 2009 and mash it up with the speech from Into Darkness and you've got the end? Wait, wow. Did I just say that out loud?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I hate to say that, but it's
true.
You know, visually it's very true, and a lot of the speech hits a lot of the same kind of points that Kirk's speech at the end of Into Darkness has, and so, you know, about darkness and coming out of it kind of thing, and like, oof,
they even said something about out of darkness, and I'm like, you mean into darkness?
Ooh, yeah. Hold on. I've got the speech at the beginning. She says, there were triumphs, victories of spirit, courage beyond reason. But make no mistake, these are bleak times, times we cannot repeat, times we cannot forget.
Mm-hmm. It's very similar to Kirk's speech at the end of Into Darkness, like thematically, and in some cases I think even some of the phrasing is the same. There's phrases that are like the same.
Yeah.
And I also just thought it was a word that she used. I think, doesn't she use the word righteousness? Doesn't she say righteousness?
Yes. Oh yeah.
That's a really weird word.
Well, that's her quoting some ancient like sea mariner at the war zone. Remember, that's not actually her wording.
Oh, okay. All right. I missed that.
Yeah. That's battlefield thing. Yeah. That she's quoting or whatever. But yeah, it's really interesting that they would, yeah, it's just, okay, sure. We're getting a little too into it, you know, like into our own kind of propaganda here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whatever. It was certainly rousing. It was certainly cool. Like, it was certainly, if you don't turn off your brain, it was very nice and rousing and very, you know, Sonequa, of course, delivers it excellently and sure, but Jared, you can say the word. You can say the word. I know you want to say it about it's kind of
preachy.
Unearned.
Oh, unearned. Yes. Yeah. Unearned.
And I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Yeah. Jared, ever since you said on the last podcast that they haven't earned this, that was just ringing in my head, watching the finale. Yeah. I have to say.
Yeah. It just didn't seem like it. There's also a bit self-congratulation to this kind of thing where it's like the creators are patting themselves on the back.
Yep.
Like,
yeah.
At the very,
for sure.
The,
oh my,
like,
God, we made it to the end of the season.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's like the closing scene of Inglourious Basterds where Brad Pitt is staring at the camera and he said, and, you know, when he's about to carve the swastika onto Christoph Waltz's head. And he says, this just might be my masterpiece. And then it cuts to the thing that says, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, right? He's talking about himself there. So kind of get the same idea sometimes. But here, I think he's doing it tongue-in-cheek, so I forgive him, and I love that movie. But here, like, they're patting themselves on the back, and they don't deserve to. It's not earned.
Right. Well, no.
Yeah.
Now, to be clear, those guys behind the scenes have had a hell of a time. It's been very tumultuous. They've lost a showrunner. So in that sense, sure, they kind of deserve some kudos, but, you know, otherwise.
Narratively, though. Narratively.
Narratively, exactly. Narratively.
I also think there's a lot of heroism in not congratulating your heroes, right?
Sure.
Like in the book, The Lord of the Rings, nobody knows about the hobbits at all. Nobody in, you know, like all of Aragorn's people, they don't know about the hobbits. They've never seen them. They saved their lives, but they have no idea about it. Where in the movies,
yeah, because
they, in the movies, they did the opposite, right? Where they, like, cheer them and they all bow to them and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's more heroic for them to not get the pat on the back.
Yeah. Well, and this is like, you know, it's like Kirk's speech. Like, look, this is what we're out here doing. This is what we do. We don't need to be applauded for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's what they do. It's ethically what they want to do, and it's their job, right, to be out there on the front line of Starfleet.
Yeah, in a super clandestine secret Black Ops mission, you don't hold parades for Black Ops missions,
right? Yeah. So that reminds me of all of the threads that they didn't tie up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which we will get into, right? Our next show.
Right. Yeah. Yes, well. Right. Yeah. We have to hold that off.
Yeah. But just to go back to the unearned part of it, I mean, the speech Burnham gives where she's talking about the triumphs and the victories of spirit and the courage beyond reason, ostensibly, she's talking about the war, right?
Yeah, which we never saw.
Which we never saw, and they weren't really involved
in. Right, because they were being told to be kept on the periphery because of their unique spore drive. They had to be kept aside.
So it's another one of these instances where we're watching all this pageantry and all this, you know, pop and circumstance over something
telling that
we never saw.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So I'm watching this at the end and I'm like, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no resonance.
Like, what is the, why? There's no emotional resonance whatsoever.
Nope. So kudos to all the actors for making us buy it. Because in that moment.
They're in there pitching. The actors.
Because, you know, while you watch it.
Do their best with the material they've been given.
I believe that speech while I'm watching it. You know what I mean? Like, I buy it until you stop and you go, yeah, but what? Where is it all? Where was all this? You know? Anyway, I think before we leave our Paris HQ, I would like to say it is nice to see that the whole bridge crew, including people who didn't get to talk a lot, right? At least they're there. They're all getting decorated. That's nice. It's not just like the, you know, the five people we saw forever and had speaking parts. Like, Arium's there. Bryce, all these people are actually there getting a decoration, which is nice, because at the very least they got thrown a bone.
I was going to say, don't say it. Kayla was there.
What? Oh, I didn't. Well, I would have called her by her last name, Detmer, but that's okay.
Good.
I know. She can't have your
there
name.
There can only be one.
At least she spells her name differently.
It's true.
That's the only thing you got. Yeah. That's the only thing you
keep. She spells it wrong.
Yeah, she spells it wrong. Well, no, in the future, that's how they spell it, Kayla, okay? So.
Oh, they spell it wrong in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's morphed. Totally. And, of course, it was really nice to see Stamets holding a medal for Culber, a posthumous medal, and that was nice.
And then Michael gets her commission back.
Yep, so now she's back as a full commander, but the nice part is that she's still in the science division, so she's not in the command track, she's in the science division. Which is good. It seems fitting for her. And then I have this little note that says, you know who else that sounds like? Well, let's see. Somewhere in the next 8 to 10 years-ish, some other person who's also a science officer will become a lieutenant commander. Not quite the same rank, but almost. And a first officer of another ship that maybe we'll see in a minute. I don't know.
You mean of the N? See? See? Oh my god, you guys.
Yeah.
One.
The suspense. Oh, shit.
Seven. It's the USS Enterprise.
What? You don't say. Yeah. So, anyway, it's kind of fun that it's fun and, I don't know, also sort of silly that, hey, there she is, about 8 years before her, you know, adopted brother sort of becomes the same sort of title and whatever, he or she is back where she's belongs, quote unquote, you know. So, ooh, look at that. She's like her stepbrother, but not.
Can we talk about the ultimate blue milk?
Yes, kids, here it comes. So they
by
go,
all means.
They go on their happy way, right? That Culber makes a nice little wisecrack about not using the spore drive, everything's hunky-dory, and then... Priority one distressed call.
Who could
slow,
it be?
Slow decode. Oh my god, that slow decode is like the most ridiculous thing
ever.
It was
so dumb.
Like, really? You can't send a small sequence of text, like, Really? Of course you
and
can.
And why
you
would it be separated? Like, why would there be, like, different packets sent for each letter?
There wouldn't. It makes... It's total, again,
yeah.
BS Hollywood stuff. Yeah. It makes no
it's,
sense.
Okay. Anyway. If Hollywood doesn't understand how volcanoes work, they really don't understand how computers work.
No, they totally don't understand data transmission at all. It's true. So, anyway. So yeah. In weird, almost, like, strange data transmissions of the future, we get the slow decode of the registry numbers. Oh my goodness, side eye from Michael to Sarek and back, like, uh-oh, you know. And then we get a pretty
and
cool...
the Alexander Courage theme
yeah.
gets queued up,
yeah.
and we see the Enterprise.
And it's a pretty cool reveal sequence. I like the sequence. I do like the visual effects sequence of the way it's revealed, and they sort of pull, you know, through and over the Discovery to see the Enterprise. That's a cool little sequence. Now,
the
here it comes, kids. What does it look like?
Yeah.
What do we think?
Not the original.
Nope. Now, what do we think about that? What do you guys think about that? That it's different. That it's been updated in disco eyes.
I think it's one of those inevitable problems that they have to run into, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way they can. There's no way they can do something like that and not make it look weird. Because either it's the same as it was in 1966 and then it looks so out of place, or they have to change it and then it looks wrong.
Well, then don't do it.
There we go.
Yeah.
Bingo. That's option number one, is just don't do it. Because really,
yeah.
Let's not.
Because you're your own show. You're not,
right. And
you're not the original Star Trek. You're Star Trek Discovery.
Exactly. This is a crutch. This is a crutch, and it's a crutch that says...
Oh, this is very much a crutch.
Very much. And it says, you know what? We can't do this show. We must throw something. You know, we can't do this on our own. You know, basically, like, we have nothing original. We don't know what to do.
Yeah.
We can't have adventures. You know, the vastness of space, apparently, whatever. Screw that. We're just going to throw the Enterprise at you. Ultimate blue milk. Here you go.
The ultimate
it's like,
blue
what?
Milk.
I expected at some point during the show's run that we would see the Enterprise.
And you know what? They shouldn't have done it in season one.
So
that's
early.
No, I mean,
early.
I would have thought they would want to establish themselves for a while.
Absolutely.
Really get their sea legs under them and establish an identity for Discovery before.
Exactly. 100%. Because what is Discovery? What is Discovery? How do we define it on its own? Now it's defined by seeing the Enterprise. Right.
I mean, it really is, because not only do you see the Enterprise, not only does the original series theme play, the credits are the end credits of the original series.
Ugh.
Yep. The music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Exactly. They go to the whole
It's
suite.
Like, it's almost, you know what, in a much smaller scale way, it reminded me of These Are the Voyages.
Huh. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes.
In that
good
somehow,
point, good point.
Like that, not to the same scale, obviously, but it's it feels like the original series took over the final 3 minutes of Discovery.
It did, in a sense.
They should have, instead of black background, they should have had a picture of one of the Orion slave girls from earlier in the episode.
Oh, totally.
I was waiting for it. I have to be honest with you.
Funny.
I was waiting for it to come up.
As well as the dummy picture from the Fasarius of the scary captain.
Which would have been perfect.
That would have worked.
Because of Clint Howard.
They,
you know?
They totally should. See, that's funny little fan service. That's harmless. It's fun. It's at the end, you know.
Yeah.
People.
Little too Futurama though. But
too on the nose.
I would have.
Yeah,
I would have loved it. I would have totally gone for it though if it was me.
But I have to admit though, I just thought that this was a cheap way to go and get out of the season and try to keep people to come back.
Well,
for
it's a weird way to do it because now they're
stuck.
It is weird. Right,
because
now they have to involve, because otherwise it's the ultimate, not only the ultimate blue milk, but the ultimate blue balls, right? If we come back at the end of,
nicely put.
At the beginning of next season, and
yeah,
all of a sudden they're
like,
oh,
we'll
JK, we're not actually going to show the Enterprise, they're just going to warp away.
Yeah, no, they can't,
no,
they have to do something with it now.
So now, and that's the problem, is what now, right? Because they've painted themselves into this corner.
They can't show us that bridge. They can't.
No, and they've already outright said it's, you know, Captain Pike, like it should be. So now what, right? Like, what do they do? And the two things that I can
Hunter
see...
To...
yeah, exactly. We resurrect Jeffrey Hunter somehow. No, and that's the problem, right? The only two ways I can see about this going, and maybe you guys have other ideas too, is the two ways I see is, okay, we have to go for the Uncanny Valley, you know, like CGI resurrected Jeff Conner and Leonard Nimoy
on a view screen or something.
On a view screen. And that's a terrible idea. No one wants that, right? Except for maybe, who knows? Maybe they think they do. But no, no one wants that in the fandom, I think. Two, the only other thing that I can think of... Okay, well, short of recasting, sorry. So there's always this thing where you could recast, okay, right? They would cast somebody who looks somewhat like Jeff Hunter. Someone looks somewhat like young Leonard Nimoy. I also think that's just as much as a problem as CGI rep. So the other thing is, they can kind of cop out and make it some kind of audio-only transmission. And then they get somebody who kind of sounds like Jeff Hunter to
but
record
But we know
some
their
audio.
Voices.
Well, but again, you get somebody kind of sounds like Jeff Hunter vaguely... It would work.
Yeah, you could probably find someone who could do a decent impression.
And then you just record this audio-only transmission. But then they still have to leave somehow, right? We still can't ever interact with them. It still is basically a big tease. Like,
yeah, I mean, this is designed to be the cliffhanger of the season. I can't imagine that this is not going to go two or three episodes into season two.
Right. And it's like,
how could it not?
If they're going to go that far, that means they've got to cast a Jeff Hunter and Leonard Nimoy lookalike. They just have to at that point.
Right. Oh, God, no, don't.
Yes, I know. It's a terrible idea. And they did this to themselves because they couldn't resist.
I think they could do it in one episode. Resist. Maybe they have something clever up their sleeves. Hey, you know what?
Let's hope so.
I have to say, Matt, I think you hit on a really important point here, and it's something I don't want to dive too deeply into, but I feel it's relevant, so I'm going to say it, is that, you know, this season has been really tumultuous for the writers with losing the show, you know, losing Brian Fuller, and so I think they've had to do a lot on the fly, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens in season two because they're really starting with a blank slate. So,
yes, they are.
So I think it's going to be hard to predict what season two is going to be like based on this season, just because of all the difficulties that they've had to work through to make it work.
Yeah, very good point. I agree with that. We really don't know where season two is going to land. We just don't yet.
So maybe they have the most clever solution to this up their sleeves. Ever the optimist
something
over
tells
here.
Me no, but yes. Something tells me no, but yeah.
It's a non-zero chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, it's a non-zero chance, yes. but yeah, so they paint themselves in this corner, and it as cool as it is, like, to see it and whatever. To go back to the redesign, I know we sort of talked about the sort of you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't sort of thing. I would say, though, that there was actually a fan video that, aside from some wonky nacelle animation, did a very good job, I think, of keeping mostly the classic lines of the TOS ship, and they kind of changed the skin of it, you know, the little Aztec-ing and some stuff to make it more disco-y, but they didn't actually redesign, like, the geometry of the ship itself, and it looked fine to me, I thought. I don't know why they felt the need to actually go, like, flatten the neck out a little, add, you know, more struts, like, supports to the pylons and stuff. It's like, I don't know, why did you need to do that? Just 'cause, mostly, I think. It's not terrible. I don't hate it, but it's just like, okay, what? Why?
Why?
I will say they did a couple of cool things that I do think that one nice bit of continuity that they've sort of done with this redesign is the warp nacelles themselves are very reminiscent of what the NX class had, which is nice. So if you're going to connect it to things, okay, cool. It kind of looks like it connects sort of backwards and forwards that in that sense, right? And it looks, it borrows a little from what we know the refit will eventually look like. And so it kind of plays a little bit of a middle ground with some disco flair thrown in. And so in that sense, it's not bad, but why? Why did they even have to bring it in, right? Why did they have to even involve it at this point?
Yeah, it's another one of these instances where they're kind of boxing themselves in.
They sure did.
Yeah, it also, Brian, I like what you mentioned about these are the voyages. It really undercuts our heroes as heroes to say, okay, wait, but then there are these other heroes you actually like better, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was reading a review today where somebody said that where, like, they were like, oh, wait, so the Enterprise is here. Oh, I'd rather just be on the Enterprise.
Yep.
Yeah, I've seen a few people say that. It's like, why didn't we have a prequel with, like, Pike and Spock going and doing stuff? And it's like, yeah, that's true, right? Like, why didn't we then, you know?
Pike series would be fun.
Yeah, oh, sure. They could get someone else to play number one. That would be cool.
Yeah, I would be way into that.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of number one, I have a theory that number one is the captain that they're supposed to pick up.
I hope so. That would be really cool. I hope so.
Interesting.
Because they didn't reveal any identity whatsoever. Yeah.
Why do you think it's her?
I don't know. Just a hunch. It has to be somebody. You would think it would probably be somebody from that era.
Mm-hmm. Huh. They'd want to put somebody you know. Well, either it's someone that nobody knows at all, or it's a cool name drop like that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, the fact that they're kind of holding it back and they're not saying we're going to pick up Captain So-and-so on Vulcan.
I think it's just because they haven't read it yet.
I think it's because they don't know.
Well, it's entirely possible that they're, yeah, it's too. Entirely possible. Yeah. But anyway, I was just throwing that out there.
It would be cool.
You know.
Fuller certainly kind of liked number one. You know, he has talked about her. But of course, Fuller's out. But still, he liked her. So maybe they
more
would,
woman
you
know, power on the bridge. It. I'm for that.
Yeah.
And it would explain why, like, you know, like, Discovery was on its way to Vulcan when they run into the Enterprise. Maybe the Enterprise had just dropped her off or something like that. I mean, I'm just totally making that up, but
yeah, we'll see. It's a good thought, though.
I guess we'll see how they play it. I think it's a giant minefield for them to navigate.
It is, yeah.
They're not making it easy on themselves.
No.
No.
It's like you said, no. I think they basically just have to be like, all right, and then pivot away from this, like, really quickly.
I think they can only have the Enterprise there for, like, an episode. That's my guess.
Yeah. I'm just stepped to get away from
it. I hope you're right, actually. Like, you know. All right, say hello to everybody. Wave goodbye to Spock and Captain Pike, and then go off and be your own show. Otherwise,
yeah. You know. It's like, you know, when you have a spin-off show and the ratings aren't so great, and so they have a walk-on role with someone from the original show, and it's awkward.
Yep. Well, to go back to this whole, they really shouldn't be near the Enterprise anyway. If you figure, one of the things that people have sort of thought kind of almost fits with canon is why in TOS Starfleet feels pretty stretched out is, okay, well, this is why, right? The Discovery explains it in the sense that they just totally, like, wasted a ton of the fleet. A bunch of the fleet's, you know, down and out. So then things are a little more kind of Wild Westy and things are more stretched thin. So if that's true... Yeah, no, you should not be running into the Enterprise. The Enterprise should be way out on patrol somewhere doing their kind of, you know, border patrol stuff. And you should definitely not run into them routinely. You know what? Like, you shouldn't. That's a TNG era thing that you run into more people routinely. This era, you should definitely not run into people, you know, just routinely. Yeah. It shouldn't be. So, you know.
Yeah, one of the appeals of the original series was that there was a certain Wild West quality to it.
Right. And certainly, if they just had a massive war, yeah, the Starfleet is not very big right now. So, yeah, people need to just go out and do their things.
Yeah, and if, for Discovery's sake, I hope they branch out into things that are not tied into, like, fan service and other parts of the canon.
Yes.
Go and make create new some canon. New stuff.
Yeah.
Because if all you're going to keep doing is bumping into things from the original series and other shows, then what was the point of doing this show?
Yeah. Exactly.
Because, let's face it, we've seen Harry Mudd, we've seen the Mirror Universe, and we've seen the Enterprise.
Yeah. That checks a lot of fan boxes right
and that's
there.
And that's in 15 episodes we saw all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really, like, we've got about, you know, eight-ish years or so at this point until TOS starts. That's a long time. Go do something else. Go explore.
Yeah, go do something else.
Yeah.
You know, make the universe feel bigger. One of the problems that... has happened in the Star Trek novels and on this show is that we're constantly bumping into things we already know, characters we've already met, and it makes the Star Trek universe feel very tiny.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
So go out there and seek out new life and new civilizations.
As Michael Burnham said.
Yeah. She said it. Now let's do it.
Yeah. So let's see it.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think that's
alrighty.
It. I think that's a good way to end the podcast.
Yeah, we've
I think we've talked about it all.
Hope we haven't overstayed our welcome with you folks listening at home, at work, or perhaps at the gym. We appreciate.
I love how Jared. I love how you always like have a guess at where people are listening, like whether you're at home or at work or at the gym or riding your bike.
Or possibly in an airport somewhere, listening to it while you're waiting for connection.
Maybe in Boston.
Maybe in Boston.
So to all one of our fans hanging out in the Boston airport, hello.
don't miss your connecting flight. Yeah. You've got to make it to Chicago on time.
Yeah. And on that note, we very clearly have overstayed our welcome.
Yeah.
Well, this was a big one, you guys.
Yes.
It was.
Yeah.
Yes, and we will be back next week for one more disco podcast where we are going to look at the first season in its entirety.
I cannot wait.
Yeah. Talk about arcs and all kinds of fun stuff.
Yep. So, we'll see you then, and thanks for joining us, guys.
See you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.